And that's when I realized that John and Carolyn's death was just scratching the surface on so many other dark stories and events that follow the Kennedy family. There's assassinations, scandals, affairs, secrets, even a lobotomy. And this is The Midnight Files. Welcome to WTF Wednesday, where I find something mildly concerning, and instead of moving on like a normal person, I research it for hours. So let's unpack it together. I was watching a TV show recently called Love Story on Disney Plus, and it follows the story of John F. Kennedy Jr. and Carolyn Bessette. You watch how they meet, how their relationship unfolds, and the pressure they're constantly under in the public eye, and how that slowly started to impact them individually and as a couple. Before watching Love Story, I honestly really didn't know that much about the Kennedys. I mean, I am from Australia, and it's not really something we grow up learning about. I just kind of knew who JFK was and that he was assassinated when he was the president. But from the beginning of the show Love Story, you do kind of know it's not going to have the best ending, because let's be honest, I think most people don't normally get a TV show made about themselves unless something bad has happened to them. And for John and Carolyn's case, their story doesn't have a happy ending. So John, Carolyn, and her sister were all in this small plane that John was piloting to go to this wedding, and then basically the plane ends up crashing into the ocean and they all die on impact. After watching their relationship unfold and somewhat getting to know them as people, it was sad to see how it ends, honestly. I know a lot of the things in the show would be dramatized, but I still feel like he kind of got to know who they were a little bit. So after that, I was kind of fascinated with John and Carolyn, which kind of led me down the rabbit hole of Googling and looking into the Kennedy family. It actually kind of reminded me of this show I had watched last year on Netflix called The Fall of the House of Usher, where this family builds this like insane wealth and power, but really don't do it in the best way because it's built on like lies, cheating, I think maybe slightly satanic, but I'm not saying that's linked to the Kennedys. But yeah, it doesn't end well for the family and the House of Usher, because all of that power and wealth that they amount to ends up coming at a cost, and that cost for them is constant loss and misery as the season unfolds. And the Kennedy family, it was one of the most powerful, influential families of the 20th century, almost like royalty in America. And at one point it really looked like they did have everything, but their story is followed by so much tragedy. And tonight we're going to look into the Kennedy family, of how they rose to power and why their story feels less like history and more like a series of unfortunate events. And yes, that is another movie reference. So the Kennedy story doesn't actually start in America, but on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean in Ireland. And the family descends from Irish immigrants Patrick Kennedy and Bridget Murphy, who had fled Ireland during the Great Potato Famine, which started in 1845. And just a quick note on the potato famine. So basically a disease wiped out the majority of the potato crops in Ireland, and it wasn't like they didn't have food. They still had food that was fine to eat, and grain and all these other options, but that was being sent out of Ireland into Britain. So a lot of the Irish people were starving and suffering, and that meant that millions of people either died or left Ireland because the Irish government weren't looking after their own people at the time. So we can see why Patrick Kennedy and Bridget Murphy decided to leave Ireland, and they arrived in Boston, Massachusetts in 1848 by boat, and they arrived on these ships called coffin ships. And the reason why they were called coffin ships wasn't because they were shaped like a coffin, it was because so many people died on board the boat on its journey to wherever it was going. And I mean, that just would have had to have been so grim, traveling such a long journey on a boat like that where people were just dying around you. So the couple ended up settling in Boston, where Patrick worked as a cooper, which is a barrel maker, and Bridget ended up taking on a variety of different jobs over the years. Something that I feel like that's important in the Kennedy story is that they were Irish Catholics. And at the time, that actually mattered, because Boston, where they ended up, was predominantly a Protestant city. And because of that, they face a lot of discrimination. They had a lot of limited access to opportunities. And like many other Irish Catholic immigrants, they were also poor at the beginning. I mean, it's really not that surprising. It's not like history has never had a problem with judging people before for what their belief is it? I haven't seen that one before. So Patrick and Bridget would go on to have 5 children: Mary, Joanna, John, Margaret, and Patrick. But John dies at a young age, roughly around the age of 1, from cholera, which was quite common at the time. But something that often get overlooked in the Kennedy story, I feel like, is Bridget. And a lot of them tend to focus more on what Patrick did for the Kennedy family. Even JFK in 1963, when he goes back to visit his great-grandparents' home in Ross, New Ireland, and this was when he was president, he spoke about his great-grandfather Patrick really fondly and didn't really speak too much about Bridget at all. And what he did say about Patrick was he was really thankful for his strong desire for liberty, his deep religious faith, and the foundation he laid for his family future. He was very grateful there for the inheritance. But Patrick died at a really young age of 35. And to put it in perspective, Bridget and Patrick had only been in America for around 10 years and married for 7 years. So of course he definitely had a part in making the family what it is today, but he wasn't really there for that long and he didn't have that much of an impact on his children because he died when they were so young. And it's actually Bridget that had more of an impact on their children. He died from either consumption, known today as tuberculosis, or cholera. I couldn't get a definitive source to say which one, as the records at the time are really not as they are today. Bridget was left to look after 4 children on her own in a foreign country that she hadn't been in for too long, in a city that was mostly anti-Irish Catholic environment. At the time too, Irish women like Bridget were often dismissed or looked down on, even times being called biddies, which was basically a term used for domestic servant. She started out working as a maid and later became a hairdresser in a Boston department store before the Civil War began. And then it was said later on, I think maybe after the Civil War, she went on to become a really successful entrepreneur in her local community, owning a grocery store in East Boston, investing in property, renting out apartments, most likely to other Irish immigrants like herself. And this is why I think she deserves so much more credit than she was ever given, because she was a single parent raising 4 children after losing her partner in the 1800s, a time that would have been incredibly difficult. And somehow she still managed to build something that was actually stable and successful, and she created this foundation that allowed her children to actually thrive. And I don't feel like that women get enough credit in history. So while most people like to remember Patrick as the foundation of the Kennedy dynasty, it was actually Bridget who held it together and deserves way more than she was ever given. One of Patrick and Bridget's sons, Patrick Joseph Kennedy, would become the next step in the family's rise to power. Patrick was born in 1858, and that was actually the same year that his father passed away, so he didn't know his father at all. And he grew up watching his mother build a life of really nothing, and he didn't waste that foundation his mother built for him. Patrick J. Kennedy went on to marry Mary Hickey, who was also from an Irish immigrant family, and together they ended up having 4 children: Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., Mary, Margaret, and Francis. So Patrick J. Kennedy became both a successful businessman and a Boston politician. He built wealth through a variety of different ways, through a network of bars, alcohol-related businesses, which also helped him gain local influence in his community and connections. He also kind of had that charismatic kind of way about him, and he knew what the people wanted to hear, and he used that to his advantage. And he ended up running as a Democrat and being elected into the Massachusetts state legislature in 1884. He was one of the first Kennedys to hold public office and power. I swear this is something in the Kennedy genes, because they all seem to know exactly what to say and the people just eat it up. And honestly, I just feel like so many of them end up succeeding in whatever venture it is that they're going into. So he wouldn't end up being the richest Kennedy or the most powerful Kennedy, but he definitely opened the door for the Kennedys to get into politics. And because of Patrick came his son Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., the man who wouldn't just build the wealth for Kennedy, he would turn the Kennedys into a household name, but it's also a name that is tied to so much tragedy. Joseph P. Kennedy Sr. was born in 1888 into a family that had already begun its rise to power because of his father, Patrick J. Kennedy, and he was surrounded by influence, ambition, and opportunity from a very young age. And Joseph had some really big goals himself. That started with university. Where else would he go living in Boston at the time? To a prestigious Ivy League school called Harvard. Now, Harvard, it was competitive, but not quite in the same way as it is today. Because back then, getting into Harvard wasn't just about your grades and extracurricular activities. It was also about who you knew and your family's status. Lucky for Joseph, he had a father with political influence, strong community connections, and money, which definitely didn't hurt because without that, it's very likely on grades alone that he wouldn't have been able to get into Harvard, especially because he was also Irish Catholic and wouldn't have been seen as the right fit for the school. And even though he got into Harvard and he felt like some doors were opening to him, there were still a lot of limits because the Kennedys came from an Irish Catholic background. And even in the early 20th century in America, when he was at Harvard, they were still discriminated against, and that meant exclusion from some of the most powerful social financial circles. And he never really felt like he was accepted by his peers, and there's a lot of clubs at Harvard that Joseph would never be able to be a part of, not because he didn't want to join them, but simply because he would never be invited because of his background. And you couldn't just simply sign up for a club, you had to be invited to these specific ones. At the time, Boston's elite was really dominated by what they were known today as the WASPs, which is the White Anglo-Saxon Protestant Group. It wasn't an official organization, but it really might as well have been, especially in like the social circles. They were the old money, the Protestant American elite, controlled opportunities and decided who belonged and who didn't. And if you were Irish Catholic like Joseph Kennedy, you were automatically on the outside looking in. If you think about it today, in today's standard, it's just so wild to think about that that was even a thing that people had to go through. Because it's a religious group who thinks they're better than everyone else, and doesn't that kind of go against the whole premise of their religion and like accepting and being kind to people and not judging people? And like, you know, it's not like Joseph came from poverty either. He was actually from a pretty well-off family at the time. But in those spaces, it just really didn't matter at all. So even with all of that against him, he kept studying. He made some connections with people. He wasn't like a standout student, but he did pretty well and he graduated in 1912 with a degree in economics. But again, graduating from Harvard didn't magically open all these doorways for him like it did other people. He faced the same barriers he faced in Harvard in the real world also. And honestly, it just felt like at this point in his life, he just really couldn't catch a break, all because of where his background is from. So naturally, like any stressed out 20 something that can't seem to get a job anywhere and has a very convenient safety net, he went straight to his father for help. And through his father's connection, he actually managed to get a job in banking. And to be fair, once he had the opportunity, he didn't waste it. He moved quickly, and by the time he was 25 in 1914, he became one of the youngest bank presidents in the United States, taking over the Columbia Trust Company in Boston, which also was not so coincidental as it was the only Irish-owned bank in Boston at the time. So yes, he did get help getting in the door into banking. The bank he was working for really wasn't thriving. It was actually really struggling and was at risk of being taken over. And he actually played a major role in turning it around and saving the bank. And he proved that he could actually do the job. So now that Joseph had the makings of a successful career, he started looking into other avenues of making money, gaining power. And one of those was who he could marry. Rose Fitzgerald was born in 1890, and she was raised to be deeply religious and had a real love for music, especially the piano. She wanted to study piano. history, languages at Wesley College, where there were more academic freedom, you could have more independence, critical thinking. But no, Rose's dad, John Fitzgerald, said, no daughter of mine will be studying at a Protestant school. So instead, Rose was sent to the convent of the Sacred Heart and then later to a convent boarding school in the Netherlands called Bloemendaal. I felt kind of bad for Rose, honestly, because she really doesn't get to say much in her life at all. And she says later in life that not attending Wesley College was something she always felt really sad about. But on the other hand, she has said that she believes her religious training at the convent school really helped shape the foundation of her life. So basically, she was making the best out of a bad situation and she was already really religious. It does make you wonder though, kind of like, where would Rose be if she wasn't forced to go to a convent school and she could have made her own decisions for herself. Clearly she had a talent for music and she had a genuine interest in history and languages. Sometimes I think we forget about how lucky we are in this day and age to have freedom to choose our own path, because for us, the hardest part is figuring out what we want to do, not asking for permission to actually do it. Well, for the majority of people, I'd say some people kind of go through some hardships like that, but majority of people. And then when Rose finished studying in the Netherlands, she returned back to Boston, but again, she didn't get to do whatever she wanted. She then had to start accompanying her father in all of his political engagements. Again, putting aside her own wants. So you can kind of see like this pattern in her life where it's just slowly preparing herself for what's to come. A life of being a politician's wife and living constantly in the public eye. Rose came from one of the most powerful political families in Boston. Her father, John Fitzgerald, more commonly known at the time as Honey Fitz, was the mayor of Boston at the time when Rose and Joseph met and started dating. Honey Fitz was known for being a charismatic, deeply influential figure in the Irish-American politics. He served as the mayor of Boston twice, and during his time in office, he worked on modernizing infrastructure, improving public health, and trying to manage tension between different social and ethnic groups. Which, to be fair, was a big job. His time in office was pretty standard for that era. Before he was the mayor of Boston, he served in the US House of Representatives and later returned to Congress back in 1919. Joseph and Rose actually met through the tight-knit Catholic social circles in the early 1900s, and it's believed they first met at the Old Orchard Beach when Rose was only 17 years old. But Rose's father didn't approve because she felt she was far too young at the time for a serious relationship. So what do you do when your father tells you to stay away from a boy you like? You do it anyway and hide it. The two of them began meeting in secret, having little rendezvous behind the scenes, which actually was pretty controversial for the time, especially given how religious they were. The families like the Kennedys and the Fitzgeralds were moving in the same circles, just not on the same level yet. And Honey Fitz's hesitation wasn't just about Rose being too young. There was definitely more to it. He didn't think Joseph was good enough for Rose. More accurately, he didn't think he had the right social standing. But Joseph really wanted the relationship to work, and as he started finding success in banking, things began to change, because it turns out Honey Fitz didn't just warm to Joseph, he warmed to what Joseph could offer. And with the more money and more influence and a clearer future ahead of him, Joseph started to look less like a risk and more like someone that could actually elevate the Fitzgerald family even further. After several years of dating and Honey Fitz finally on board with the idea of Joseph, they ended up marrying in 1914. In what became more than just a union of two people, it was a union between wealth and political power. It's hard not to wonder and question the motives of Joseph. Was this really a love story or more of a strategic move into Boston's most powerful political families, especially when you consider that Joseph courted Rose roughly 7 years, and then he would go on to have numerous affairs, with some of them being quite public while they were still married. In the 1920s, Joseph decided to go into a new venture, the world of the stock market. And at the time, that was largely unregulated and insider trading wasn't illegal. Market manipulation was really common. Joseph understood how the system worked, and more importantly, ultimately how to use it to his advantage. He made enormous profits during this period of time. In the early 1920s, Joseph Sr. joined the stock brokerage firm Hayden Stone & Co., where he became an expert in the then unregulated market, a system by today's standards wouldn't just be considered unethical, but outright illegal. Then in 1924, Joseph Sr. was hired to protect the Yellow Cab Company from a bear raid, which is where investors deliberately tried to drive stock prices down. He successfully defended the company by manipulating the shares, but was later also suspected of carrying out a bear raid himself to profit. So although at this stage he is really starting to make more of a fortune for himself, but he's definitely relying on some increasingly shady behavior to get there. And somehow, very conveniently, Joseph got out of the stock market just before the stock market came crashing down, that caused that little event in history. It was known as the freaking Great Depression. And by the end of 1929, he was sitting on an estimated $4 million. Today, that is around $75 million, which is very impressive timing. Suspiciously impressive. But hey, maybe he was just incredibly lucky. When the majority of America was struggling just to get by, Joseph had cash and he had a lot of it. And as property values collapsed across the United States, he began quietly buying, creating a monopoly for himself. And he wasn't just buying small purchases, he was buying major assets in Boston. In 1933, he bought a mansion in Palm Beach for around $120,000.
The mansion sat right among the elite Protestant circles that had once shut him out. And of course, he managed to secure a prime waterfront property.
Which I feel like was definitely intentional, and I see what you're doing there, Joseph. And he didn't just stop there. Through the 1930s and the early 1940s, Kennedy expanded into New York, acquiring commercial buildings at what were essentially Great Depression prices. He was definitely in a position to buy up properties because he knew the market would recover and make a lot of money when it did, and you can't really blame him for that. But at the same time, he was buying when most people had literally lost everything. People who didn't have much of a choice but to sell. It was definitely a smart business move for Joseph, but it also meant building a lot of wealth while lots of other people were struggling. And when you add in things like insider trading and the timing of those real estate deals, it starts to feel like he might have been picking up a bit of bad karma along the way. And then in 1943, what was said to be one of his most strategic purchases,
he bought multiple properties around 59th Street and Lexington Avenue in New York
for around $1.9 million, reportedly putting down only a fraction of that in cash of around $100,000. He used leverage borrowing heavily to control high value assets, a strategy that would allow him to expand rapidly without tying up all his capital in one purchase. Then in 1945, he made what many consider to be one of his greatest deals, was he purchased the Merchandise Mart in Chicago for roughly $12 to $13 million. Kennedy used extreme leverage, reportedly putting down as little as $700,000 to $1 million in cash. And just 15 years earlier, it had cost double that to just build the Merchandise Mart. So he really got so many buildings that were worth so much more, like in millions of dollars more, for a fraction of the cost. Then Joseph turned to his next venture. When Prohibition ended in 1933, Joseph wasted no time at all. He secured exclusive US importation rights for several major British and international distilleries through his company called Somerset Importers. Brands like Hague & Hague, they sell a Scotch and Whiskey blend.
It was a blended Scotch whiskey.
Gordon's Dry Gin, and then some other European spirit brands. This wasn't illegal because Prohibition had ended, but it definitely fueled long-standing rumors that he had connections in the alcohol trade during Prohibition and took part in the illegal distribution of alcohol. There's never been any definitive proof of that, but there's been so much speculation that kind of makes it feel like it's true. Joseph later sold Somerset Importers in 1946 for around $8 million, which is roughly $100 million today. Even the name Somerset and Porter may have not been a coincidence. It's most likely a point of reference to the exclusive Somerset Club in Boston, a club that did not allow Irish Catholics like Joseph to join. So I think through a lot of his decisions, we are seeing a little bit more of like a vindictive side of him coming out and his quiet desires to prove something to the people that did once exclude him. And I can't really blame him for that because he went through so much discrimination from an early age. So now his wealth really was just continuing to grow. He had success in the stock market, real estate, strategic investments, property, and then he would continue on to also having some success in the film industry. He was involved in Hollywood, including the restructuring of RKO Pictures. And by the end of the 30s, it was estimated that by short selling and reinvesting real estate during the Great Depression, his fortune was around $180 million, which is around $4.23 billion today. It's just insane that he managed to get that amount of wealth. Now, while Joseph was making some big money, he was also making some pretty big decisions, mainly in the form of multiple affairs. In the late 1920s, he moved to Hollywood so that he could be with his mistress, Gloria Swanson, while still very much married to Rose, who was at home at the time looking after their 9 children. And Joseph and Gloria weren't exactly subtle about their affair either. They were seen out together, openly acting like a couple. We can't not mention that Gloria was also married at the time. And just to make things even easier for the couple, Joseph definitely had a hand in getting Gloria's husband sent off to work in Europe so they could gallivant around Hollywood, walking hand in hand like they weren't married to other people, weren't cheating on their partners openly. Joseph didn't just get involved in Gloria's personal life by shipping her husband off to another country or another continent. He got involved in her career too. He backed her film queen Kelly too and encouraged her to invest her own money into the project and positioned himself right in the middle of production, which in theory sounds great, except the film went wildly over budget, production fell apart, and it was never properly released to the US. So now you've got a half-finished film, a lot of money gone, and Gloria's reputation taking a serious hit in Hollywood. Hollywood was already shifting from silent films to talkies at the time, which didn't really help, but this situation definitely didn't do her any favors either. And then just like that, Joseph was done. He was done with Gloria, and he ended their relationship and went back to his wife and kids and carried on like nothing had happened. Meanwhile, Gloria's career had stalled, no one really wanted to work with her, and then her marriage didn't survive the affair either. So it definitely did not work out well for her. And obviously, she can't be a great person either because she was openly having an affair, but Joseph really fucked her over. All of this is just starting to feel kind of on brand for Joseph at the moment and his kind of ethics and morals he goes by in life. Because Gloria wasn't the only affair he was linked to. There were several other affairs that he was thought to have had over the years. It just wasn't quite as in the public eye as the one he had with Gloria. Maybe he learned one thing from the whole situation and was to keep it a little bit more hidden away. So Joseph, back with the fam, back on the estate, you know, remembering he's got a wife and 9 kids. Did he choose to reflect publicly on any of it? Probably not, because he continued to have affairs after. And I think he was just like, right, what can I do now? I'm obviously pretty bored with my life, so I'm just gonna try and make more power, make more influential decisions. So he turned his interest to politics. And with all that money he had, he decided to be a major supporter of Franklin D. Roosevelt in his presidential campaign, using his wealth and influence to back the future president. And when Roosevelt won, Joseph was appointed the first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission in 1934, which is where it gets a bit more ironic, because now he's the one introducing and enforcing regulations to stop insider trading and market manipulation. Under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, the government brought in strict rules to clean up the stock market, cracking down on things like insider trading, where people use non-public information to make profits. and Joseph was right at the center of helping bring structure and oversight to what was previously a very unregulated system. Until you remember, he's now making illegal the very tactics that made him super, super rich in the beginning. Clearly, he didn't want anyone following in his footsteps of making as much money as he did in those ways. But as I mentioned earlier, Joseph and Rose had 9 kids. Joseph Jr., John, who we know as JFK, Rosemary, Kathleen, Eunice, Patricia, Robert, Jean, and Edward. Which already feels like a lot, but it wasn't just a big family, it was a very intense one. And I don't even think they realized how, like, the kids didn't even realize how unusual, like, their upbringing was, because it was just normal for them. Like, it's normal for parents to have expectations on their kids and they want them to succeed, but this was like that, but like on steroids. And I don't really feel like their emotional care was probably there as much, because there was so much pressure, so much discipline, and everything was kind of competitive and very controlled. Joseph was dominant and strategic, while Rose was probably a little bit more structured and deeply religious. And I think they just had this expectation that they wanted their kids to be really good at everything, like getting good grades, having a good social life, getting into politics, all of it. Failing at something in that household would have been, well, kind of awkward and not really accepted. More of that, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed vibe, but like really intense. Even dinner wasn't a time of relaxing. There was no small talk. It was like time to have a debate. Let's talk politics. Let's talk world events. Let's talk the economy. Nothing about what you got up to with your friend on the weekend or what holiday you're going on. And like, there's this scene in the TV show I was talking about earlier, Love Story, that shows this really well, where Carolyn goes to dinner at the Kennedy house for the first time. And she thinks it's just going to like a normal family thing, chatting, getting to know everyone, but it's so not. And it turns into like this full-on debate led by this lady called Ethel, firing questions off at different people. And like Carolyn's just sitting there thinking, holy shit, when's the question gonna come my way? I don't know about any of this stuff that they're talking about. You know, it's like all about economics, politics, world events. And everyone's just expected to just keep up with whatever Ethel is saying. And obviously Carolyn has no idea what's going on, because for whatever freaking reason, John didn't tell her that this was a thing that happens at their dinner table. And she's just left to feel like super uncomfortable and just feels out of place and feels kind of silly. So I feel like that just really shows they just have this like ridiculous high standard on like everyone in their family. Like, take a break, guys. Have a chat. Relax. It's not going to kill you. They're probably more likely in this family to die from a plane crash than just to have a nice civilized chat at the dinner table. So there was just like this incredibly high standard in the Kennedy household. And Joseph had kind of set his next goal on his son, Joseph Jr. He wanted Joseph to end up in the White House, of course. He wanted him to be a president of the United States. Joseph Patrick Kennedy Jr. was born on the 25th of July in 1915. From the moment he was born, his dad had big political plans for him. I swear, like, these extroverted genes and traits run in this family, because Joseph Jr. was apparently intelligent, confident, and naturally charismatic, and people really loved him. He also attended Harvard, like his father, and was known for both his academic ability and his strong personality. But unfortunately, Joseph's political career would have to be put on hold, because there was that little thing also called World War II that started happening. Yeah, so he willingly joined the United States Navy and became a naval aviator and flew multiple different missions. By 1944, he had already completed a number of dangerous assignments, but then he volunteered for something that was even more extreme, a classified mission known as Operation Aphrodite. The idea behind Operation Aphrodite was experimental and highly dangerous. He was to pilot a Liberator bomber that would be filled with explosives. Sounds super safe, right? And then pilots that, and then basically they would take off in the aircraft, get to a certain point, then they would have to eject themselves from the plane. Then that plane would be controlled remotely, so then it could go over to where German targets were. It's essentially an early form, an idea of a guided missile. But it was like incredibly unstable. And on August 12, 1944, Joseph Jr. took off from England in a plane packed with explosives. And before he could bail out, the whole aircraft just exploded in midair. And the explosion was so powerful that absolutely everything was destroyed. And Joseph was killed instantly. He was only 29 years old. And there was no warning, no chance of escape, and no final moments for him. Just a huge explosion in the sky of a big accident. The official explanation of the explosion was caused by a technical malfunction, apparently, as the equipment used in Operation Aphrodite was new, really experimental, and known to be quite unreliable. It was just a super unsafe mission for him to be sent on, or for anyone to be sent on. But of course, as with many of the Kennedy tragedies, there are many theories and conspiracy theories. And of course, I love looking into people's conspiracy theories and seeing like what little ideas people come up with. And sometimes I feel like there's a lot of truth into them, and sometimes they just sound downright crazy and absurd. Some people have suggested that the mission may have been sabotaged from the very beginning, and the explosion was intentional before Joseph could get out of the aircraft. Others question why a mission that risky would be given to someone seen as the family's best shot at presidency. And then there's a slightly darker conspiracy whether Joseph Sr. and the family had already started shifting their hopes towards JFK instead of Joseph and wanted Joseph Jr. out of the way entirely. And importantly, there is no credible evidence to support sabotage or any of these theories. They're just interesting theories out there that may be true. Who knows? But what we can't deny is that Joseph Jr. was from one of America's most ambitious political families, and he was placed into one of the most dangerous experimental missions of the war. And I wonder, did he choose the mission willingly, or was he like more pressured into it? But I guess we'll just never know. 1 year prior to Joseph's death in 1943, something had already kind of begun to shift from the focus from Joseph towards his younger brother, John F. Kennedy, who we know as JFK. Joseph Jr. had joined the US Navy in 1943, and so did his younger brother, JFK. But JFK was serving the US Navy in the Pacific during World War II, a slightly different area to where Joseph was serving. And JFK was in command of a patrol torpedo boat. On the night of August 2nd, 1943, in the waters near the Solomon Islands, his boat was struck and cut in half by a Japanese destroyer. Two of his crew died on impact, and the rest were thrown off the boat into the dark ocean, injured, disorientated, and miles from safety. I mean, I would just be thinking about sharks. Like, I'd be stressed out. I would not want to be stranded in the ocean like that. But this is where JFK becomes a war hero. Over the next several days, he led the surviving crew through open water, swimming between small islands, including Plum Pudding Island and later Olasana Island. At one point, it was said that JFK swam for hours, towing a badly injured crew member with a strap clenched between his teeth. He continued to swim out into the open water at night, trying to signal at passing Allied boats, but was not having any success and no one was noticing him. So he is trying to get creative on how he could get help and how they could get rescued. And what he managed to do was get the help of two local Solomon Islanders to pass a message he had carved into a coconut shell, and he needed for the Solomon Islanders to give this coconut shell that was stationed on Nauru Island, where they were, to Allied forces that were on coast watch on that island. And I think it was like a mix of New Zealand and Australians. And he was just hoping and praying that that message would get to them without them being discovered by the wrong people. He carved into the coconut as much as he could, and it said, "Nauru ISL, Commander Native knows post it, he can pilot 11 alive, needs small boat, Kennedy." And days after this, as they were just kind of sitting there hoping and praying again that they received that coconut shell and they were going to get help, they were rescued. And like that story just spread so fast that this young naval officer leading his men through endurance, determination, and he managed to save everyone, really created this like really positive war hero kind of image for JFK. So now we've seen a pretty shady rise to power, cheating, and Joseph Jr. killed in a plane crash. And what follows after this starts to feel less like a coincidence and more like a never-ending series of bad events. Next week, we will delve into even more craziness, assassinations, more affairs, a lobotomy, and yes, somehow more plane crashes. I don't even know how one family can end up with that many plane crashes. And like having one plane crash happen to your family is like crazy, but to have like three plane crashes also is just insane. And that's today's WTF Wednesday. Thanks so much for watching or listening, however you've stumbled across this channel. Let me know what your thoughts are in the comment. And if you like the video, please give it a like. That'd be super nice. And I'll see you guys next week in the next one for part 2.